you are a serious fan of the James Bond films, and in particular the music from the James Bond films, you may well have been able to identify that music. It's some of the theme music for the Bond film called Goldfinger. It featured the John Barry Orchestra, and it is one of the pieces of music that are part of an exhibition at the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music. That particular one having to do with the James Bond theme. It's called Music to Live, Die, and Love Another Day. This is Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly. The show's your connection to local performances and sometimes to local archives and exhibitions. And that will be the topic of the first part of our program today. We do have some performances to talk about coming up at around 4:30, and that has to do with performances of the ballet The Nutcracker with music by Tchaikovsky, of course, performance by the Champaign-Urbana Ballet on the stage with Sinfonia da Camera in the pit at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Those performances happening Thursday, December 5th through Sunday, December 8th. And my guests will be Terry Bush, who is one of the dance parents and also chair of the publicity committee for the ballet, and then also Toby Martinez, who is ballet mistress for the CU Ballet Company. That's coming up at around 4:30. But first, I want to talk with Scott Schwartz, who is the director of the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, which is based at the University of Illinois in the Harding Band Building, which is where all the bands are based, a stellar band program at the University of Illinois, which is actually the subject of one of the exhibitions, which are all grouped under the title for American Music Month, which is actually ending in about 3 days. American Music Month, that is, not the exhibition. It's called On the Road Again, Cruising Coast to Coast with America's Music. And there are several exhibits in a fairly small space that you can go view and that Scott is in charge for. It's a very bad preposition. Scott, thanks very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
And thanks also for giving me a tour of the space. I was finally there. You and I have talked a number of times. I've heard for many years about the Sousa Archives and never had gotten myself over there.
It was good to have you.
It was fun to see some of the things. We have an underwriting announcement that mentions it regularly on this program. And so it was good to see sort of the context for everything. I got a chance to see some of the very old instruments that you have there, saxophones, clarinets. Did I see some cornets, maybe? I didn't see some of the bigger instruments.
Yeah. No, most of the bigger ones are off-site in proper storage. But everything from, piccolos and clarinets to, the Solmar construction, just in exotic sound recording equipment. So,
and Solmar construction, we'll perhaps mention a little bit later. It's an exotic instrument, to say the very least. Well, give us really quickly a thumbnail sketch of what the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music are at the University of Illinois for.
We preserve the music of faculty, students. We have three distinct collecting areas, wind band music, with Sousa forming the core of that. We have electronic music, a very prominent body of stuff, with the Solmar construction forming a core of that. Ethnomusicology, with the Bruno Metal papers and the Robert E. Brown Center for World Music records, a fairly current acquisition. And I said three, and we have a fourth that we've just started on, local music. The Champaign-Urbana community has a vital performing arts scene, not just straight music, but rock and roll, jazz, pop, folk. And so we're beginning to collect in that area, and it's quite stunning what we've been uncovering.
So when you say you have music, that means literally the pieces of paper that represent the music, but also in many cases recordings that that also represent the oral part of the music.
That's correct. Business records, papers, photographs, the full gambit of materials. We just had two visitors here this morning looking at some of the historic instrument collections, which we often think are museum-based, but they're all tied to the wind band tradition. So we had flugelhorns, cornets, and cornopians pulled out for them to play and experiment with.
Cornopians?
Cornopian, a predecessor to the cornet. It has a Sturzel valve as opposed to a Perinet. So if you were a brass player, you'd know that right away.
Well, I was a brass player. What's a Sturzel valve? Is that the rotary valve?
No. A Sturzel valve is a hollow valve. The air passes down through it. So if you were to look at the cornet, you will notice that at the end of each one of your pistons, you have tubing coming out to continue. So the air goes down and around as opposed to across, which would be something you would encounter with a Perinet valve, which is a more modern valve. And the rotor is just a modification of that concept.
This really is something you would have to see to know exactly what we're talking about. I've taken apart trumpet valves, and I've taken apart French horn valves, so I know the cross the thing, so I'm trying to imagine the down the thing, but we're just going to leave that alone. I was just kind of curious on that point. But you indicated that there are different ways and different places in which to see the collections. The exhibits, which we're going to talk about representing American music, are in the archive, are in the main space, I guess, the main exhibit space, the public space. Mm-hmm. The people can come in and actually look at. They're under glass cases and the usual thing. But there are also other places where instruments and music are stored that I imagine people could see by appointment.
Yes. A large bulk of our collection is stored off-site in the Archives Research Center. And when people want to look at that material, much like the folks who came by today, I just go to that facility and pull those instruments and bring them to the SUSE Archives. So for the most part, if you want to look at our collections, whether they're at the center or at our off-site storage, we bring them to the SUSE Archives for you to access. And that includes paper records, photographs, audio recordings, the full gambit.
So if somebody wants to see the exhibits, which we're about to talk about, they can just show up more or less during the hours, and those are online, posted online. If they want to see something maybe isn't in there, then it's best to make an appointment, say what they think they might want to see, and you can probably enlighten them on some other things they could see, and then arrange for them to come once you've had a chance to get it over there.
Oh, that's exactly it. You know, often they'll ask, can I look at brass instruments? And I'll give them the finding aids to two or three of the collections, and I'll say, tell me what you'd like to look at. And they'd shoot a note right back to me and say, I'd like to look at these. And it's a matter of just pulling them and bringing them to the center.
And some people do make arrangements because they're researching a topic. Some do, I guess, as a point of curiosity.
That's it. We have many performers who come. They'll be passing through town. We have a trumpeter from the Chicago Symphony who wanted to look at Herbert L. Clark's cornets. Heard much about them, and Henry Distin in particular. So, you know, I pull that out and let them, you know, play that, and it's an opportunity to experience a piece of the history of that performance tradition. And then we have scholars who come and spend weeks looking at things. So we full gambit.
The sort of blanket title for the current exhibitions, some of which have been there for a while, some of which will be there for quite a while yet, is On the Road Again, Cruising Coast to Coast with America's Music. That overall official title kind of goes through the middle of December. We talked once before on this show about the exhibit that's been there since April, the James Bond theme, et cetera. So we're going to pass that one over, but you have three that have to do with SUSE and photographs coming from members of SUSE's band. You want to talk a little bit about those?
Well, this year's theme focuses on the 100th anniversary of the Lincoln Highway in travel. Charlie Strothkamp played in the SUSE band 1920s. He was a clarinetist. The family was quite envious of the fact that he traveled so extensively with the band, and in 1929 bought a Chandler and started traveling, the Lincoln.
A Chandler was a car.
A Chandler was a car. You know, think of it as the equivalent of a Cadillac in 1929.
A nice car, then.
A very nice car. And they traveled many of these highways, and Charlie took extensive photographs of their trips. So you can see, you know, the famous Lincoln picture from Washington, D.C. You can see the Washington travel camp they parked their car next to. And just get a sense of what life was like to travel on the road in the 20s and 30s, very different from what we think of as travel by car today. And it's just a sample of what life was like on the road.
And that portion is it's in its own case.
Yep.
So you can get through this exhibit very quickly. You know, mm-hmm. you can walk around it, and then you're done. But there's a lot to read about the photos, some background, mm-hmm. and if they're lucky enough to encounter you while they're there, which is mm-hmm. highly likely, then they can get all the background that isn't even on the cards.
Well, that's it. You can only describe so much in an exhibit caption. And their photos themselves, whether we're talking the Strothkamp family travels or Otto Meslow, who was another Sousa band member who played in the 1890s with the band, you only get a snapshot, but much more of the content is contained within a collection. So that's what I can present to people and give you a little more context. My favorite picture is the Indian Gap photo, Smoky Mountain National Park. The Indian Gap Road is no longer open to cars. It's now a hiking trail. But at that time, this would be 1930, the cars parked pretty much where everybody else who hikes that stretch of road or path can actually stand and look at that same valley. And it's quite stunning because I've hiked it numerous times. It was a fun picture to actually put on exhibit.
I'm trying to remember if I got to the Indian Gap when I was to the Smokies when I was a kid. Couple of the photos that you had shown me in, I think it was probably the Strothkamp exhibition, were photos I've seen. I mean, were places I've seen myself. And as you commented to me, these are, you know, kind of like anybody's family photos, except at a time when things really were quite different. Not least the photographic processes.
Well, I think what's most intriguing is the fact the photographs were taken right at the start of the Great Depression. And so we often in our minds think that no one traveled. You only traveled if you were looking for work. And yet the Strothkamp family had money and did travel. And so it's a different perspective of life. Of course, about 1932, eventually even the depressed economy caught up with the family, and so they stopped traveling, sold a car.
Those specific exhibitions called Traveling America's Early Highways, a Strothkamp Family Road Trip, 1920 to 1930, and A Musical Life, the Travels of Otto Meslow. And again, Meslow and Strothkamp, both members of the Sousa Band. Mm-hmm. And then you had the exhibition, How the Sousa Band Music Library Came to the University of Illinois, which is itself kind of a fascinating story.
Well, it is. We're often asked the question, so the bottom line was, why not do an exhibit explaining how that material came to Illinois. Victor Herbert's, when he died, his music collection was sold piecemeal. That bothered Sousa very much. Original scores sold for $10 at auction, and Sousa absolutely refused to let his library suffer the same fate. So in 1922, he decided he was going to give his music to the People's Library, Library of Congress. And that was advertised, or at least in newspapers, for several years. Not sure what happened, but suspect the relationship Sousa had with A. Austin Harding, that strong relationship and the fact that Illinois had such a good band, was the motivation for eventually giving most of his performance library to the University of Illinois in 32.
And I had a quite enjoyable experience of looking at the piccolo, the handwritten piccolo part to probably Sousa's most famous march, Stars and Stripes Forever. And I was amazed that there were no marks on it other than, you know, the music itself and how neat it was.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And for the most part, you know, performance practice was not notated. It changed from performance to performance. So the musicians just knew to watch Sousa from the podium. And, you know, when he decided to have a section drop out, he'd just wave them off. There was no time to notate that. Next concert, he changed it up again. So you really, to understand the performance practice, you have to look at the papers of the various musicians to begin to understand how he worked from the podium.
And it's encouraging to know that at least in some organizations, the instrumentalist actually had to watch the conductor on occasion. It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm talking with Scott Schwartz, who is director of the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, about their current exhibitions having to do with various aspects of American music and with some photographic exhibits related to the Sousa Band. Our programs today are made possible with support from Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713. Scott has brought with him a couple of other guests to talk about an exhibit we haven't so far mentioned, and that is called Live from the Crossroads, a snapshot of Champaign-Urbana's local music scene, much more current than the Sousa exhibitions, 1980 to 1986. Scott, you want to introduce your guests?
Well, we have Della Perrone, who's the photographer, and I might add an exceptionally talented photographer who has let us use her photographs of the scene. And Rory Grennan, who is one of the part-time assistant archivists who helped curate the show and has a very strong breadth of knowledge about the local rock scene. And between the two of them, they pulled together a set of photographs, and we pulled together a wonderful exhibition.
Just to sort of set the context for at least part of this exhibition, I'm going to play one of the recordings that folks can hear if you go over to the Sousa Archives. And I'll play it, and then I'll let you guys say who it is and why this person is significant. Called Twang Bar King, Adrian Belew and the Bears, one of the groups that was active between 1989 and 2000 and represented in this exhibition, Live from the Crossroads, snapshot of Champaign-Urbana's local music scene, at least the part from 1980 to 1986. So who was Adrian Belew, or is he still around very much?
You want to talk about that one, Della?
is definitely current. Adrian lived too. He's played with how many different groups? We can go back to Talking Heads. He was discovered by Frank Zappa. He's a big part of King Crimson for 20 some years, and David Bowie. I ought to stop before I start really trying to dig, but it goes on and on and on. You can get his whole history on his website, adrianbelew.net. But he is very well known for his guitar innovation, unique sounds, as you could hear from the piece you just played, from his second solo album, which is it's the title cut, Twang Bar King.
So that one was, I said Adrian Belew and the Bears. It was not. That was a local group.
That was his solo group. And the Bears actually started here, but three of the members of the Bears were from Cincinnati, Ohio. So, but they rehearsed and developed the band here while Adrian was living here. So we think of them as being from Champaign. They're also from Cincinnati. but their rehearsals and many of their songs were written right here. So currently, Adrian is involved in several projects about ready to tour with the Crimson Project, which involves two former members of King Crimson, Tony Levin, and the drummer Pat Mustel. I have a hard time pronouncing his name because no one's ever pronounced it for me. He also has the Adrian Ballou Power Trio, which is just like it sounds, a power trio. And his number of solo records out and recordings and it's a well-known producer as well. So
how did you come to be taking photographs of some of the groups that were active in what was a really vibrant music scene? I mean, it's vibrant now in Champaign-Urbana.
Yes, it is.
But not to the degree probably that it was in the 80s, very early 90s.
It really was a golden era for music in this community. And I think looking back and through this exercise of putting this exhibit together with the Sousa Archives has really brought that home. You know, get a sense of what happened until you look back at it with some distance. And for a lot of people looking back at it now, it was pretty darn vibrant and pretty special. There were a lot of bands that were signed from national labels coming out of this community. I kind of stumbled into it. I didn't sit down and say, gee, I'm going to go photograph rock and roll, you know, I kind of grew up with photography in my family, and I got my first camera, and this band, it really was the Elvis Brothers probably that became my, you know, the first band that I shot, definitely was. And we went to see this little band, this little trio, and I was like, gosh, I really like to photograph them. And one of their early gigs, I photographed them, and the photographs turned out very well, and one thing led to another, let's do this, let's do that. And we started putting things together, and then people, you know, it just sort of spread from there. You know, people liked what they saw, and asked me to come photograph them, and I did. So I did it for a number of years, was involved for a number of years until I realized that I didn't like the dark room. And so I just kind of quit for a long time until digital caught up, and now I'm back to photographing lots of things besides bands.
So when you say that they liked it and then asked you to continue, they meaning the bands themselves.
Yes, exactly.
So these were sort of archive photos for the bands.
Well, we used them as promo photos, and we did live work. We attempted studio work. I'm not, you know, my studio work was pretty rough, so I didn't know what I was doing. But they had a lot of character, and it just so happens that the bands I was working with had a lot of character. So it was a nice balance. It just worked out really well. I really had a lot of fun doing it. It was exciting. It was interesting. It was challenging. It was all the things that, you know, I wanted to do at the time. So, and I worked always in black and white. So,
were you yourself a groupie of some of these bands? Is that how you ended up there?
No, I would not say so. I would say that I was a music fan. But no, I would not define it as that.
Somebody saw your photos who told somebody else who told somebody else, and then they liked what you did, and it goes on from there.
Right.
And who were some of the other groups? I mentioned Adrian Ballou and, in the case, the Bears, the group that was here. Who else? You said the Elvis Brothers.
Yes. There was a band called Nix 86 I worked with a lot. I worked with the Vertebrats. I unfortunately don't have that material anymore. Worked with a band called The Martyrs, which were actually a really great little indie band that put out a record when they were, you know, in high school. And they were part of, they actually did a reunion show just a few years back. It was really pretty wonderful. And they're, most of them are still playing. They're still, you know, one's a professional, several of them are professional musicians now to this day. I'd have to look up and go any further. And then I did some, you know, I did some national acts because I worked with a concert promoter that was out of Champaign. And he asked me to photograph his concerts for newsletters and marketing to colleges, et cetera, for bookings. So I would travel a little bit for him, which allowed me some national acts. So it was really whatever came in the door that it would allow me to keep photographing. I was doing it.
And these are photographs by Della Perone that you can see as part of an exhibition at the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music at the Harding Band Building at the University of Illinois in technically in Champaign, that part That's of right. the campus, called Live from the Crossroads, a snapshot of Champaign-Urbana's local music scene, 1980 to 1986. And the exhibition largely gathered together by Roy Grennan, who's also with us here on Live and Local. So how did you get involved in this, and how much of the scene did you experience firsthand?
Well, I'm a musician myself. My main instrument is electric bass, and I've been playing with rock and blues and jazz combos in this town for over a decade, probably longer. So I've got quite a bit of firsthand experience with the music performance scene in this town. And so I'm sort of the, now that I work at the University Archives, I'm sort of the go-to guy for music questions. Especially rock music. Yeah. And the whole collection effort that we've got going on at the Sousa Archives right now sort of sprang from an everyday question that I got. Someone from the Alumni Magazine was writing an article on the 70s rock scene here, and they were looking for photos, and I had a tough time finding them. And it just sort of, it's one of those things that sticks in your craw. It's like, well, why can't we find photos of the 70s rock scene in this town when there's such a wonderful, rich, you know, musical heritage here? And so I brought it up to Scott, and luckily I was able to convince him that there's a direct line in American popular music from John Philip Sousa right up to today's rock and roll.
What were some of the bands you were involved in?
I've played with groups that no one will remember, I'm sure.
You never know.
I started playing bass in a group called Monkey Butler. I was in a group called Sick Day that had a little bit that we traveled, and we got some local radio play back in the day. People might remember that. Most recently, I played with a folk rock group called Hathaways, which was fronted by two very talented siblings.
Both of whom have been on the show, actually.
Kate Hathaway and James Hathaway. Mm-hmm. I'm not surprised that they've been in this studio, who are actually touring Peru right now. So if they're somehow listening on the internet, hey guys, how's it going? Bring the full band with you next time.
It would be a nice tour for you, wouldn't it?
It would be nice.
So was it, I mean, you said that it was, you obviously did find Della as somebody who has done some of the photos. What about pulling together the non-photographic material? Was that a particular challenge, or was that easier to find information?
It's been challenging, but it's been fun as well. Luckily, I have a lot of contacts in the local scene I was able to draw on. And then it was like we were talking about word of mouth. You know, somebody's friend tells their friend. And I've been lucky to get a lot of good referrals lately. And so as you know, as we move sort of outward, you know, from a random spot in the middle of the scene with me and, you know, the people that I know directly, we're finding some interesting collections. And a lot of people who are enthusiastic about seeing these materials preserved.
So this is a newer venture for the Sousa Archives, Center for American Music. It's one that will no doubt grow, and there will be other exhibitions that you can see. This one is Live from the Crossroads, snapshot of Champaign-Urbana's local music scene from the early 80s. And there's another one that we're going to have one tiny audio sample from in just a moment. And it, speaking of legacies from SUSE, celebrating the Harding Hindsley Bijan Keen Band legacy at the University of Illinois. Those are the last names of the first four directors of bands at the University of Illinois band program, which is, I believe, the largest in the country, probably the world as well. And I want to say thanks to Della Perrone, Roy Grennan, and especially Scott Schwartz, who's director of the SUSE Archives. And go on over there. Check it out. Explore the American music exhibits. Ask Scott to see some of the instruments. Some of them are pretty fascinating.
Yeah, definitely. And if you have a chance, to December 14th, we've got a great concert of the three high school concert bands playing at the Virginia Theater. And just more great music, another part of the local scene. So,
And we will be talking about that, I believe, on December 10th.
That's great.
We'll have the band directors of all three of the high school bands here in Champaign-Urbana. Thanks to all for coming on the show today. And again, check out the archives. It's a pretty fascinating place.
Thank you, Kevin.
It's live and local on FM 90.9. It's called University of Illinois March, played by the Illinois Wind Symphony under the direction of James F. Keene, the fourth director of bands at the University of Illinois, here on Live and Local on FM 90.9, where we have support from Community Blood Services of Illinois, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products for hospitals and patients throughout our region. Blood donations help save the lives of the injured and critically ill. Information is available at bloodservices.org. The Champaign-Urbana Ballet and Sinfonia da Camera will perform this year's rendition of The Nutcracker, music by Tchaikovsky, Thursday through Sunday, December 5th through the 8th, at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts at the University of Illinois in Urbana. My guests this portion of Live and Local are Terry Bush, who is a dance parent and also publicity committee chair, and Toby Martinez, who is ballet mistress for Champaign-Urbana Ballet Company. Thanks to both for joining us on the program today.
Well, thank you, Kevin.
Thank you very much.
This is, I don't know, do you know, Terry, how many Nutcrackers now that the CU Ballet has done?
This is their 11th year performing at the Krannert Center, but I believe we're in the range of 15 years of productions for the CU Ballet.
In some form or another, and each of those years has had some form of the Nutcracker, I think, or nearly all of those years.
Well, the history is probably easiest to explain in terms of building the company. At the outset, there was not a huge core of dancers with CU Ballet. So they were performing scenes beginning in 1998, and then were able to mount their first full-scale production of The Nutcracker in 2001, actually at Parkland College Theater that year. And then in 2002 was the full production, 2001 still selections from, and then in 2003 began the run at Krannert with Sinfonia da Camera.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And Toby Martinez, who's the ballet mistress, is experiencing her first Nutcracker with CU Ballet, joined the company in January this year. Congratulations on getting the gig. Where were you before and what were you doing? And a little bit of your own dance background.
Well, I received my Bachelor's of Fine Arts from the University of Utah back in 1992. And since then, I've taught ballet and been involved in various productions kind of all over the place as I followed my husband, who is a United States Marine, retired now. But this will be our first time as a ballet mistress with Champaign-Urbana Ballet, involved in the Nutcracker. Last year, I was a parent. My daughter was a first-year company member last year.
So you have experienced CU Ballet locally, but not in your present role.
No.
Yeah. I had a conversation with a previous ballet mistress and asked her the same question, but I'll ask you as well, because the role may be different with you in it. I don't know. And that is what a ballet mistress does as opposed to what the artistic director does, artistic director being Deanna Doty, who's, of course, the founding artistic director of the company.
Yes, Deanna is definitely the vision of Champaign-Urbana Ballet. My job as ballet mistress is to stage choreography, make sure that the children all know what they're doing, keep them safe, escort them to different areas so they get to their spots on time and safely. Oh my goodness, there's just so much.
So when you say stage choreography, what does that mean separate from creating the choreography? And is that, when you say stage choreography, does that mean teaching them the choreography?
It does. So when you stage a ballet, it's usually based on choreography that is already existing. So a lot of what I do is teaching the dancers the existing choreography that has been done in the past. But what I also do is original choreography. Like this year's Ribbon Candy Dance is brand new. It's a delightful little dance. I had help from Ben Chapman. He's one of our senior company dancers. And they got a brand new dance this year.
And what is Deanna's role in teaching the choreography as well? I mean, I assume she has one.
Oh, absolutely. So Deanna does also restaging of the ballet. The ballet is her baby. It's her choreography primarily that is presented. She's teaching the kids the finesse that they need to perform the roles accurately, and then constantly tweaking and adding new parts. So what you see in One Nutcracker in the past will not necessarily be what you see this year. Every year, the ballet takes on a different flair for the strengths and the weaknesses of the dancers that we have. And boy, we've got a great cast.
Well, you mentioned Ben Chapman. He's in the role of the Cavalier, which is the name that is given to the guy who gets to dance with the Sugar Plum Fairy, right?
Absolutely.
And features prominently in which dances particularly?
So the Cavalier is an Act Two dancer. He does several solos. He also does the pas de deux with the Sugar Plum Fairy. And then we've also utilized him in some other roles in Act One, so you'll see him as a party dad. We keep him busy.
He, in this case, meaning not the Cavalier, but Ben Chapman.
Ben Chapman, yes.
Yeah. I've always wondered, and I don't know if I've asked this question before, is the Cavalier actually a character? Because most of the show, once you get past the family scene at the beginning, most of the ballet is the character of Clara observing things that happen essentially in a dream. More or less.
You are correct. It is a dream. All of Act Two is her dream of this beautiful candy assortment of sweets. But the Cavalier is a character. He's essentially, if you could call him maybe the king of the land of sweets, that would be the closest thing that we would have to that.
That is some of the pas de deux between the prince or the cavalier and the sugar plum fairy. Tchaikovsky's music called The Nutcracker here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. My guests are two people involved in a production of The Nutcracker by the Champaign-Urbana Ballet and Sinfonia da Camera that will happen December 5th through the 8th at the Kranert Center in Urbana. Terry Bush, who is a publicity committee chair and also one of the parents of dancers, and Toby Martinez, who is the ballet mistress. The family scene is exactly that. There's a lot of families milling about and involves families of some of the dancers. Terry Bush, mm-hmm. is a dad of one of the dancers. Do you actually get up on stage?
Not yet.
Mingle about?
Not yet, but wait till next year. It could happen. You never know.
Has somebody been trying to twist your arm?
Yes.
and you're suggesting they might succeed next year.
They might succeed next year. I was able to stall them for this year because I am in the new role of publicity committee chair, new to me, and could see that that was going to be a fairly involved and time-consuming job. So I wanted to understand that one before I took on any additional responsibilities. But my daughter is dancing in her second Nutcracker, and she is a mouse in the battle scene that follows the party scene that you're describing.
So for somebody like your daughter who is a mouse, which is, I guess you could literally say a small role in that a mouse is at least in real life relatively small, what does all this mean to her? You know, what's her involvement with the company, with the academy, which is kind of a separate organization, assuming she's involved with both? Mm-hmm. And then how does she get up for this? You know, what does she take from the whole thing? At what age?
She is seven.
She's seven.
A lot of different layers to work through. Let me start with her role, because she's actually Mouse One, which means that she appears in all of the performances. The ballet has learned a lot over the years about how to manage a train of 12 mice. Lead them across a stage that's very crowded with rats and soldiers and so forth. Get them in the right place at the right time so their moves match the choreography of other characters on the stage and match the music and so forth. My daughter, being Mouse One, she's essentially the locomotive of this train of 12 mice. Mouse 12 is also the same in all of the performances. So you've essentially got the engine and the caboose the same. And from seeing the ballet last year and hearing Charlotte's descriptions of all that she must do in order to get that train in the right place at the right time on several cues, it's really complex. And it's fun watching her translate that to I have to get close enough to this rat so I could give them a high five as I lead the mice in a circle through the stage. It's that kind of complexity. What she gets out of this long term is much, much bigger. This is a very professional organization. The dancers are very talented and very, very committed to what they do. In a sense, I could not pick a group of better role models for a young child than we have right there at CU Ballet. They're showing her every day that if you want to succeed in this or anything, you really have to work at it. You don't just wake up one morning and say, I'm going to go dance Clara. It's years of work to get to that point. And that's a message that is a very important life message. So it's been a great experience for us.
Is she involved in the academy?
She takes classes, yes, actually from Miss Toby, as Charlotte calls her.
Toby, I was going to say Toby Maguire, but you're not Toby Maguire. Toby Martinez also starts just about the same way, who is the ballet mistress. We're talking about the production of The Nutcracker with music by Tchaikovsky by the Champaign-Urbana Ballet, which opens on December 5th, continues through December the 8th, Thursday through Sunday. And Symphony of the Camera, conducted by Ian Hobson, occupies the orchestra pit at the Center for the Performing Arts in Urbana. Charlotte, mm-hmm. is your daughter's name?
Yes.
Does she envision herself first perhaps as Clara and then perhaps as the Sugar Plum Fairy? Is that her ballet ambition, or is that premature to say?
She would love to dance the role of Clara. What lit her up about ballet was watching The Nutcracker on television. She was maybe 3 or 4. And she just was absolutely enchanted by it. We saw the next year, we saw the CU Ballet production. And I said to Charlotte when it was over, is this something you want to be part of? And she said, absolutely. So we started classes. She auditioned. She was cast the in the 2012 production as a Polo Chanel, and she's had her sights on Clara ever since.
So look out, whoever's got the role now. I think they're safe
for a few more years.
Well, plus kids grow up, and you know that person, those people, really, because it's danced by two different characters, Lauren Frost and Lara Morgan.
Yes,
they may have their sights on the Sugar Plum Fairy, or you know, one of the other even busier dancers. Clara gets plenty to do the first act, not so much the second, right?
She's actually on stage for the entire ballet, so there's not much rest for Clara. But they do all aspire to other roles. What one dancer starts as a Paula Chanel, for instance, Taylor Federson, who is one of our Sugar Plum Fairies, she started as a Paula Chanel, and now she is a Sugar Plum Fairy. So they do aspire to that. But there's so much in the ballet, and every dancer looks at all the roles, and they find something special in every single one of them.
And about how many dancers involved?
We have 130 dancers performing this year.
Actual dancers as opposed to family milling about who aren't necessarily dancing? Or do they count?
I count everyone as a dancer. We do have some children who haven't had a dance background. But we want to give them an opportunity to experience the theater, which is a big part of what we're about, is trying to get more people involved in ballet. And we also have some wonderful adult cast members who have come in, and they are really working. I tell you, the athletics of my rats is quite amazing.
So the rats are adults, or some of them are?
Some of them are adults. And they, oh, wow. They jump, they leap, and when they come on stage with their glowing red eyes and they look at Clara, they scare me.
And one of the parents, who of obviously an adult, has been playing the role of Herr Drosselmeyer, the, let's say, magician, for lack of a better term, the uncle, who, and he's been doing it for a while, Brett Federson. And then Chris Oakes is the other one, and he's also a parent.
He is.
And so everybody gets involved somehow, sometimes quite prominently.
Sometimes they do. A lot of times we'll get them into the studio as just, you know, a party dad who is learning their very first time that they've had an experience with ballet. And we'll see something special. And we'll just kind of keep advancing them through. And they end up in a role like Drosselmeyer.
The Champagne Urbana Ballet production with Symphony de Camera of the Nutcracker, December 5th through the 8th. If you want more information on CU Ballet, the web address is?
CUBallet.com.
Oh, that makes it easy, doesn't it? And if you want information on getting tickets, you can go to the Krannert Center website. Performances all at the Krannert Center at the University of Illinois, KrannertCenter.com, or the phone number 800-333-6280, 217-333-6280 or 800-KCPA-TIX. Again, web address, the easiest way to find all that, KrannertCenter.com. I want to say thanks to Terry Bush, a dance parent and the PR person for the company, and Toby Martinez, who's the ballet mistress, experiencing her first Nutcracker in that role with this company. Thanks very much for joining us on Live and Local.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's music from Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker, Waltz of the Snowflakes, here on Live and Local, played from the recording by the Montreal Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Charles Dutoit, with obviously a children's choir joining. Wanted to mention a couple of tornado relief concerts that are happening tomorrow. Well, at least one of them is tomorrow. It's a relief concert for the city of Gifford, town of Gifford, happening at 8 o'clock tomorrow at the Iron Post in downtown Urbana. And that will involve various musicians brought together with the Community Center for the Arts. One of those musicians will be in our show tomorrow to perform live, a singer-songwriter named Rebecca Rigo. That'll be on tomorrow's Live and Local during the 4 o'clock hour. And then actually tonight at 7 o'clock, a tornado relief benefit concert by the Peoria Symphony Orchestra, along with various other musicians and vocalists from Central Illinois, including a performance in the lobby that starts about an hour from now by members of the Central Illinois Youth Symphony. That'll be at this Peoria Civic Center Theater coming up tonight. You're listening to 90.9 WYLL FM and HD Urbana with translator W293 AF Danville, NPR, classical music, and more for Central Illinois. WYLL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. For Live and Local, I'm Kevin Kelly. Be back tomorrow at 4. We'll also have, by the way, a live performance by the Sycamore Brass Quintet, also giving a benefit concert this weekend. It's 32 degrees coming up on 5 o'clock.